ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It's D-Day for residents of the west end of the iron ore mining town of Port Hedland in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. They only have weeks left to sell up or forfeit access to a buyback scheme offered to them because of concerns about dust exposure coming from the town's port. But some residents say they won't sell and are determined to stay.
There is a number of residents that I know that purchased in the boom and are sitting on million-dollar mortgages, which actually can't get an out for their bank, even with the 35%, because they can't cover that mortgage cost. So there's a lot of people who can't sell.
And we'll meet the priests from the Pacific filling a shortage of church leaders in northern Queensland.
It's like we are creating a home or space, a safe space away from home, that they are free to come and share whatever the challenges that they are going through.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. Ben Benasik relies on medicinal cannabis to manage chronic pain after cancer. But under New South Wales law, the medicine that keeps him going could get him arrested if he drives. He lives in the small village in the Wallandilly Shire, southwest of Sydney, where there's almost no public transport. He hopes new legislation before State Parliament could finally let patients like him drive safely. Kelly Fuller has the story.
42-year-old Ben Benasik knows what it's like to have his life put on hold because of pain.
So, on my chest, that's my normal side. This is the other side. So I developed a type of cancer in this section called DFSP.
Here he is at a New South Wales parliamentary inquiry in August last year. Sitting in front of the MPs, he loosened his tie and unbuttoned his shirt to show a large scar and skin graft on the right side of his chest.
It's a type of cancer that sort of looks like an octopus. It digs into your skin and your muscles. So I have no muscle tissue at all on that side of my chest. Despite walking around this building and looking normal at all times, I'm in chronic pain constantly, and I'm prescribed a number of different medicines for that.
The former mayor of Wallandilly, south of Sydney, lives in Thirlmere, a town with almost no public transport where most people drive long distances to go to work. Ben Benasik relies on driving to get to his job, yet the medicine that keeps him functional could also get him arrested.
So I take 7 different types each day. When you see me all the time, I have taken cannabis within the last 24 hours. I know if I'm pulled over by the police today and they test my blood, it will be in my blood. It stays in there for up to 90 days. So I'd like to know from the members of the government and the opposition as to why myself as a medicinal cannabis user must be put on opioids. Why is it that your two major parties are in favour of opioids and antidepressants, but not in favour of medicinal cannabis? Or are you okay with me breaking the law of New South Wales and driving without those changes taking place?
The inquiry found that the presence of cannabis in a driver's system does not necessarily mean they're impaired. However, it did not make a specific recommendation to the government. Opposition MPs on the committee pointed to evidence from Transport for New South Wales that showed cannabis was the most common illicit drug in fatal crashes from 2019 to 2023. Ben Benasik thought the outcome was an injustice.
So I was really disappointed, honestly, with the outcome of the review and the dot points that came to the government. My patients and the patients of people that drive because they have to out in Wallandilly has run out.
In Tasmania and since March in Victoria, magistrates now have the option to decide whether or not to cancel a driver's licence of a person who tests positive to THC and is using prescribed medicinal cannabis. In April, the New South Wales Drug Summit urged a medical defence for cannabis patients driving, but the government deferred a decision pending expert advice.
I'll call a member for Sydney.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Last week, the issue returned to the Parliament.
I move that a bill be introduced for an act to amend the Road Transport Act 2013 and the Marine Safety Act 1998 to limit when certain offences relating to driving a vehicle or operating a vessel with the presence of certain drugs in a person's oral fluid, blood or urine apply to users of medicinal cannabis.
With the most influential member of the lower house crossbench, Alex Greenwich, moving his motion on the issue.
This reform is for people across New South Wales who every day have to choose between taking legal prescribed medication, for pain management, sleep, anxiety and a number of other health reasons, and working or visiting a loved one.
The bill would provide a defence in court for 6 months after assent.
I'm very pleased Alex is doing this because it's going to allow patients like myself to be able to safely drive.
Ben Banasik says it's offering hope to many people.
And I know of three other patients locally that have lost their licences and are at risk of losing their jobs because of being on this and being pulled over. It affects people a lot. I've already had calls from some people I know that are going through and watching this and wondering if and when they'll get their licence back.
In March, it'll be 5 years since Ben Banasik's diagnosis.
So my doctors are very happy with my progress now. 3 years on from taking the medicine, I've built a business, I've worked for a state member, I've ran a council campaign on my own, and I'm midway through completing my PhD, all on this drug, and I feel that if I can do all of those things, I can certainly drive as well.
Councillor, political staffer, academic and advocate Ben Banasik, ending Kelly Fuller's report.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
There are growing calls for an investigation into the flood insurance classification of the southern New South Wales city of Wagga Wagga. The CBD was last inundated in 1956, and a 1 in 100 year levee protects the community from the adjacent Murrumbidgee River. Despite this, residents say premiums have gone up more in the last 5 years than ever before, and now they want answers. From Wagga Wagga, Melinda Hayter reports.
When David Maligan opened the renewal notice for the insurance on his new build unit in central Wagga Wagga earlier this year, he was convinced there'd been a calculation error.
The annual premium just skyrocketed from $500 to just under $9,000 a year. So we started looking around for other insurers that would take on our property. Going through probably maybe 8 insurance companies, we could not get quotes below a few thousand dollars.
According to local insurance broker Georgina Brown, it's not an isolated issue for the nearly 70,000 residents who call the city home.
Among the 4 or 5 insurers that we have that issue home insurance, I would say that the premiums have gotten worse in the last 5 years than in any 5-year period prior to that. And it definitely seems to be a whole market approach.
In 2020, a $23 million upgrade of Wagga's main city levee, which protects it from the Murrumbidgee River, was completed. The levee is rated to protect the central business district from a 1 in 100 year flood. The project was initiated following major flooding on the Murrumbidgee in 2012, which resulted in the CBD being evacuated for just over 24 hours, but did not lead to inundation. The last time that's happened was 1956. Advocacy group Committee for Wagga lobbied for the levee upgrade. CEO Scott Sandbrook.
It's really made the central business district floodproof. We receive a lot of feedback from residents in central Wagga. They ask the question, why are they paying more money now than what they ever have before when the CBD is safer than what it ever has been? They've got to get some sort of answer.
Levee banks have been lauded by the federal government as a way of helping reduce insurance premiums in flood-prone communities. In a 2023 speech, former Assistant Treasurer and Minister for Financial Services, Stephen Jones, said a levee built in Roma, Queensland, after flooding in 2012, reduced premiums by an average of 34%. The Insurance Council of Australia says the Wagga levee upgrade has been incorporated into the National Flood Information Database, a key tool insurance agencies use to determine flood risk to individual properties. Georgina Brown says despite repeated attempts to investigate the cause of the high premiums, she's been consistently informed it's due to climate change. The insurance broker isn't convinced, though.
I have done a few dummy quotes here or there, and there are huge inconsistencies. I tried to quote a property in town in the Wagga CBD, which was returning a premium well over $15,000, yet changing that address to an area in Shepparton that actually did flood in the last 3 years, and the premium came down to below $5,000. So there's definitely something that's not working correctly in the background.
She says an investigation's needed. Something David Maligan and Scott Sandbrook agree with.
Personally, I'd like to see a bit of an overhaul and a lot more transparency from the insurers on how they have arrived at their pricing. Many of them will send their renewal schedules out to people in the post. It'll say under the premium, if you would like information on how we've arrived at your premium, give us a call. But from everything I've heard, that doesn't really result in much enlightenment.
QBE says the company acknowledges the concerns around rising insurance costs. And RMA says it's updated pricing in Wagga twice during and just prior to the levy being completed, and that on average, local premiums decreased by up to 33%. While Allianz says it reviews flood premiums based on government maps, external data and flood risk modelling. David Maligan has reinsured his property with a new insurance provider, but says it's still double what he paid last year. It's got him thinking about the future.
There are plenty of other areas in New South Wales or Australia that have got no flood problems and much cheaper insurance. It's not going to take too much to tip us over the edge and say, well, bugger it, we're out of here.
Wagga Wagga property owner David Maligan, ending that story from Melinda Hayter. You're listening to Australia Wide with me, Sinead Mangan. It's lovely to have your company today. Now, renting in some parts of country Australia has become less affordable, according to new figures, with hotspots like Jindabyne in southeast New South Wales or Broome in the north of Western Australia. Housing experts say it's creating a massive economic divide between generations.
It's a fundamental economic issue for our country and its future prosperity. And the concern I have as a father is for the grandchildren. We are not only living in an affordability problem, we are dislocating society and we are heading for civil unrest. And anecdotally, we've got so many businesses, and I'll give some examples for Victoria. The Dalesford Cafe had to buy an aged care facility and fit it out for low-cost accommodation. The Sorrento Hotel bought an aged care facility and fit it out for low-cost accommodation because otherwise they would have no workers for their establishment.
That story coming up soon on Australia Wide.
ABC Australia Wide.
The West Australian Government has put a deadline on a voluntary buyback scheme for residents living in an area of the world's largest bulk export port town. With just weeks left, more than 100 properties remain unsold, and some residents remain steadfast in staying put. Mieta Adams has this story from Port Hedland.
Some describe a suburb in Western Australia's northwest, covered in iron ore dust, as a ghost town. That's because more than 80% of properties in Port Hedland's West End will have been sold back to the state government by the end of the year under a voluntary buyback scheme. WA Minister for Regional Development, Stephen Dawson, says the scheme was established in 2021 in response to a dust management report.
It was a Department of Environment report that was released in that kind of 2017-2018 time that said that we shouldn't have as many people living in the West End given the proximity of iron ore in that part of the world, and so action was taken as a result of that.
It was only supposed to run for 2 years, but was extended in the hope more people would sell their homes. Now, the government is encouraging others to sell before the scheme closes on December 31.
By the end of December this year, 80% of the houses in the West End will have been purchased or be in the process of being purchased. So it's certainly been successful.
But for those who have called the West End home for years, like Tina Scott, she says it has been anything but.
But what about the ones they've got sitting there vacant, that have been we're in the housing crisis, we've got FIFO police officers, we've got essential services that can't get housing, but they've got hundreds of houses sitting there empty. I'd hardly call that a success.
The state government says 299 properties have been bought back, with 105 properties remaining. Minister Dawson says the majority of houses under the scheme are still occupied under leases, while a small number were not suitable for occupancy and were still vacant. The scheme offers homeowners a price based on 2019 property prices with indexation and a 35% premium. But Tina Scott says that deal isn't good enough for many.
There is a number of residents that I know that purchased in the boom and are sitting on million-dollar mortgages, which actually can't get an out for their bank, even with the 35%, because they can't cover that mortgage cost. So there's a lot of people who can't sell.
The land in the West End has been rezoned, so no new homes can be built. Resident of 20 years, Morag Lowe, says no offer could convince her to move.
It actually suits me. It's across the road from my office. I actually enjoy living down the West End. And I think the advantages outweigh, in honesty, the disadvantages.
Port Hedland exports more than 500 million tonnes of material every year, and the dust has become part of daily life for residents.
I mean, my next task this morning is to go to a mechanic and get the windscreen jets on my car sort of declogged because, you know, they're full of dust. And then I thought, well, we're all here because of the dust. You know, if the dust wasn't here, we wouldn't be here, I guess.
Hedland Maritime Initiative has been acquiring properties under the scheme and plans to create a maritime precinct. Minister Dawson says the land that has been bought back will now be redeveloped for industrial activities.
80% is a significant number, and we will look to now consolidate bigger parcels of land and make them available for industrial uses in that part of the West End. You know, longer term, we'd still like to see everybody move out of the West End, but people have made a decision at this stage that they're not willing to sell their property, and so that they will remain as residents in that area. Because of the success of the scheme, it does mean that we can now re-embark on the redevelopment of that West End precinct for non-residential activities, and so that's the intention moving forward.
He says there are no plans to force those remaining to sell. The scheme will have a settlement period until the end of March 2026.
Mieta Adams reporting there from Port Hedland in the Pilbara region of Western Australia.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
I didn't know Melbourne much. I knew where the racecourses were.
I'm making signs for the sleepy lizards.
Basically less eggs this year than what we would have expected.
The houses that are near the edge of the bush, they might encounter a snake up to four times a year, a death adder.
See how it goes.
On ABC Radio.
Rental affordability is worse in some regional areas than in city areas, according to new research. Regional Australia has long been seen as the pressure valve for the capital city housing markets, but that's no longer always the case. Geelong reporter Jonathan Kendall has been looking into these numbers. Now, Jonathan, where is rental affordability the worst in Australia?
Well, Sinead, the area around Mount Kosciuszko and Jindabyne is ranked as extremely unaffordable. So there's a couple of hotspots here. I reckon the short stay ski accommodation around Jindabyne and Mount Kosciuszko might have something to do with that. The northwest of WA is another hotspot. So Broome was ranked severely unaffordable. So were parts of the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. In South Australia, Port Gawler and Middle Beach, that area north of Adelaide, was also ranked as severely unaffordable. And in New South Wales, Seaforth, Belrose, Avalon Beach, and those parts of Sydney, particularly to the north of Sydney, were extremely unaffordable. But they're the areas that really stood out.
Now, they use this index score to categorise whether something is affordable or not. For example, like a city like Perth, where I live, is considered unaffordable rather than extremely unaffordable. And it's got a score of 94. Can you describe how that all works?
Yeah, so these figures are from the RAI, or the Rental Affordability Index, which is released every year, and it's from National Shelter, SGS Economics and Housing All Australians. And what they've done is used data from rental agreements and compared them with the incomes, the average incomes, of 10 low to moderate income household types to find out about affordability in different postcode areas. So each postcode area is ranked from critically unaffordable to very unaffordable.
These figures have found that rental affordability is getting worse in some parts of regional Australia. Why is that?
Well, there's lots of factors, but looking at these figures and looking at the map of Australia and where is least affordable, the perfect storm for rental unaffordability really is if you live in a popular holiday destination with limited supply available. And there's other factors as well. If you're relatively close to a capital city that is also a holiday hotspot, then rental affordability is going to be low. So in Victoria, areas like Woodend, Warrandyte, the Surf Coast, which is just near where I am right now in Geelong, they're deemed the worst areas in Victoria. They're deemed severely unaffordable. Now, I met Amanda Menterplay, who is paying $400 to live in her home in Geelong. Here's what she told me.
I'm not eligible for public housing, so I have to pay for private rental. I have no choice. There is no other option. And it's either live in a house that's falling down or trade in my car for a dual cab ute and hit the road.
That's Amanda Menteplay, who rents in Geelong. How does that compare to what's going on in capitals, in the capital cities?
Well, I can tell you that Perth is Australia's least affordable capital city to rent in. It's got an average rental household paying more than 30% of their income or on rent. And in all capital cities, low to median income households have been largely locked out of those inner city areas, and they're now limited to outer suburbs where rents are still acceptable. But in Melbourne, affordability has stabilised over the past 2 years. Overall, Sydney is pretty stable as well. Brisbane got a little bit worse. Hobart and Adelaide are relatively stable. So is Canberra. And there's no data for Darwin, unfortunately. But really, the story here is regional Australia. And regional Victoria, for example, continued its decline, falling to its lowest level on record. So really regional Australia is the story from all of this.
What about if we look at age groups, Jono? Which demographics are the worst affected?
So particularly low-income household types, so pensioners, those on JobSeeker, single parents on benefits, students, and hospitality workers as well were singled out here. But what we're hearing is even if you have a decent wage, you might even be an essential worker, if you're spending near to a third of your income on housing, you're in housing stress or rental stress, and that can cause a whole lot of trouble. Here's what Robert Pradlin, now he's one of the co-authors of this report, and he's from Housing All Australians. Here's what he said about that.
It's a fundamental economic issue for our country and its future prosperity. And the concern I have as a father is for the grandchildren. We are not only living an affordability problem, we are dislocating society and we are heading for civil unrest. And anecdotally, we've got so many businesses, and I'll give some examples for Victoria. The Dalesford Cafe had to buy an aged care facility and fit it out for low-cost accommodation. The Sorrento Hotel bought an aged care facility and fit it out for low-cost accommodation because otherwise they would have no workers for their establishment.
That's Robert Pradlin, who's from an organisation called Housing All Australians. Jono, he mentioned civil unrest there. It's pretty strong words. He's mapped out the problem, but what about solutions?
Well, yeah, the report did look at solutions as well, and the authors recommend more government investment in affordable and social housing in particular. So basically, supply. The authors want more supply of all types of housing, and they say that we are undersupplied at the moment. Real estate agents, because I've had a chat with a couple of real estate agents while working on this story, and they say that incentivizing investment properties through land tax reform, those sorts of things would help, and not touching negative gearing, that sort of stuff. But the Victorian government here says it's taking action. By from tomorrow, they'll be bringing in a ban on all types of rental bidding. So that's where different prospective tenants will put in, bids to outbid each other. And landlords must provide 90 days notice of a rent increase. So that's coming into force tomorrow in Victoria.
Very interesting. Geelong reporter Jonathan Kendall, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
No dramas.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Since 1971, the number of Australians who identify as Christian has halved, leaving many communities without church leaders or services. In North Queensland, the diocese has turned to its close neighbours to help fill gaps, with ministers from the Pacific now making up half of its full-time workforce. Blending faith, culture and community has led to fruitful outcomes, as Lucy Cooper reports.
It's a Sunday afternoon in Eyre, a rural town about an hour south of Townsville in North Queensland. In the All Saints Anglican Church, the stained glass windows are beaming from the glow of the sunset. But this isn't the average Australian church service. It's the monthly Melanesian service for the seasonal workers.
It's like we are creating a home or space, a safe space away from home, that they are free to come and share whatever the challenges that they are going through. and direct them to the right places that they can seek help.
That's Reverend Jeffrey Akwai. He moved from the Solomon Islands 3 years ago to serve as the priest of St. Paul's Anglican Church in Proserpine and the wider Whitsundays region.
We as Melanesians, islanders, we come in and we try to do what we could do in this context and continue to maintain the mission and ministry of the church wherever we are.
The Melanesian service was established 4 years ago to provide a safe space for workers under the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility Scheme. John Mamarai from Solomon Islands is working in air to earn money to support his family and build a home for them. He said the service makes him feel like he's back in Melanesia.
One important thing about it is to bring them together so that in the weekends we have Bible study on Saturdays so that to bound them from going out to the clubs and the pubs and all those things, yeah, so that they can keep their money for their family.
Reverend Akwai isn't in Australia just to support Palm Scheme workers. He's helping fill a gap. Census data since 1971 showed the number of Australians who identify as Christian has halved from 86% to 44% in 2021.
It is really sad to see that the church in Australia is going through a shortage of priests and people who should be there to lead the church. So we are so happy to come share the faith.
He was brought to Australia by the Bishop of North Queensland, Keith Joseph. All up, there are 11 ministers from the Solomon Islands, PNG and Vanuatu serving parishes across the diocese.
Together they make up half of my full-time workforce in the diocese.
He said without them, the diocese and the volunteer services it provides, op shops, support to aged care homes and pastoral care to seasonal workers, would collapse.
So you're looking at each parish providing between $200,000 and $1 million of volunteer labour into their communities each year. So all that would go if we didn't have them.
These Pacific priests are so valued by the community that a migration pathway was set up between the diocese and the Church of Melanesia. It's also somewhat of an ironic situation playing out across regional Australia, where religious leaders are recruited from countries that were converted by Christian missionaries from the West.
In the Pacific, you had some of the most rapid, like the quickest and the most enthusiastic uptake of Christianity. And it is really notable that Pacific Islands church authorities are taking leadership in the societies that used to send the missionaries.
That's Matt Tomlinson, an ANU professor of anthropology and director of the School of Culture, History and Language. He said it's hard to determine how Christianity reached the Pacific.
On one hand, yeah, missionaries had to come and say, hey, there's something new. But a huge part of the story is Pacific Islanders saying, we're looking for something new and we're going to work with this in our terms.
Reverend Dr. Sepharosa Carroll is a theologian at Charles Sturt University. She says more than 90% of the Pacific population is now Christian, blurring the lines between religion and culture.
You know, Pacific understanding of faith or religion is that things are all interconnected. And I think that one of the things that that colonialism and Christian missions did that was a huge disservice was the creation of a duality between what is sacred and what is profane.
For many cultures, including those in the Pacific, Dr. Carroll said Christianity was inseparable from colonisation.
The understanding was that in order to be Christian, you must first be civilised, which equates to you must be kind of westernised.
Now in Australia, to account for dwindling numbers, Pacific Islanders are bringing their style of faith to churches across the country.
I think that what they bring, you know, in a sense is, you know, the gift of their culture, the gift of the passion of their faith, but it also brings them an uplift in their faith.
Back in North Queensland, Reverend Jeffrey Akwai said faith is something that just can't be left behind.
Coming over here, it seems that we're living in two different contexts. And it's hard to live out your culture. It's always part of us.
He's grateful for the locals who attend the monthly services, welcoming the Melanesian expression of faith and musicality.
It kind of brings the local Parisians in as well. So usually we have a combined Melanesians and Australians coming in. And our friends here, they really enjoyed our worship as well, and they felt that they are actually been nourished by that singing and dancing way of worship that we bring with us.
Such a beautiful sound. Reverend Geoffrey Akowai, the priest of St. Paul's Anglican Church in Proserpine, North Queensland, ending that story there from Lucy Cooper. And that is Australia Wide for this Monday. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.